From bureaus worldwide, this is FSM.
Thank you very much, Ollie. Welcome to Monday's Richie Allen Show. I hope you had a terrific weekend and you're in fine form this Monday. It is September 16th, 2019. It's been an absolutely beautiful afternoon in Salford and Greater Manchester. Kind of Indian summer-esque, you might argue. Lovely. I've got a terrific guest lined up for you today, an extended interview with Ryan Dawson coming up. Ryan is in Japan. I know many of you know that. Had a great chat with him earlier on. We'll hear that shortly. Before that, though, plenty to tell you because it's been a busy and a very interesting day. Welcome to your Richie Allen Show.
Richie Allen.
It's the Richie Allen Show. Broadcasting live on richieallen.co.uk and multiple platforms around the world. And now, here's your host, Richie Allen.
And you know Ryan Dawson, of course, from ancreport.com. He's a journalist, he's an author, and he's a filmmaker as well. And he's got an enormous following around the world, does Ryan. I first got to know him years ago when TPV was happening in London. He came on a TV program with me and he was excellent. And he's not been on this radio program. There's no real reason for that. It just didn't work out that he was on. But I invited him on last week and he graciously accepted. And we had a really fascinating conversation. And as I've already said, we'll hear that a little bit later on in the broadcast. So we will. In the broadcast. You can tweet this program and have your tweets read out. It's at Richie Allen Show on Twitter. I'll be retweeting my trolls. I'll be retweeting my trolls, as I've always done, because I don't get very many trolls, really. But when I do, I like to give them an old amplification. That's in the news today. Rachel Riley, Gary Lineker. I don't know if we'll dwell too much on that. There are far more important things to talk about this Monday on your Richie Allen Show. Live right now on Fab Radio 2 here in Greater Manchester, triggerwarning.tv, my website, TuneIn Radio, and lots of other platforms take the programme as well. Yeah. What have I done? I thought I'd left the window open in the studio. I haven't. We're okay. Not that it would matter anyway, because, you know, if it's good enough for Sky and the BBC to broadcast outdoors and you can hear people and traffic and sirens, it's good enough for me. It's good enough for me, I tells you. I might do it. I might do it sometime. Do it out in the backyard. Just bring the stuff down, run a couple of cables, do it in the backyard. I might do that. Right, let's get into the news because there's lots of it. Lots of it. The United Kingdom hasn't come forward with any solution to replace the dreaded backstop, so says the European Commission. Everybody has got this Brexit fatigue that they're diagnosing in NHS surgeries up and down the country. They will eventually list it as a mental illness, Brexit fatigue, and they will eventually start dispensing, what would you call it? Antipsychotic medication for people, or something like that. Psychotropic medication. Downing Street said that Boris Johnson's meeting with Jean-Claude Juncker, the EU Commission President, was constructive today in Luxembourg. They had a working lunch. How do you have a working lunch? I have left the windows open, have I? Anyway, it doesn't matter. They had a working lunch. Juncker and Johnson and their teams. And they talked about Brexit. But a statement came out after the lunch and the Commission said, well, we haven't had any proposals, really, from the controversial Brexit policy on the backstop. We've had no new proposal. Johnson said the backstop is undemocratic and said it needs to be removed from any deal that he would do with the European Union. Johnson says he still thinks he'll get a deal. The bloc, as in the European Union, says, well, we're willing to look at alternatives, but that an insurance policy like the backstop must be in place. The backstop, of course, is part of the withdrawal agreement that Theresa May agreed with the European Union. And that backstop would prevent a hard border returning to Ireland. Last week, MPs passed a law that would force Johnson to ask the European Union for an extension to the deadline on October 31st if he didn't get a deal by 19th of October. You're confused by that, are you? It's mad, isn't it? Let me explain it. Johnson says he can get some sort of a deal, but that if he doesn't, we will leave with no deal on October 31st. Last week, MPs passed a law that was given royal assent that says if by the 19th of October, Johnson has done no deal, well, he has to ask for an extension. He is legally bound not to leave with no deal. But Boris Johnson's official spokesman said the position of the PM is that we comply with the law, but we are leaving on October 31st, whatever the outcome. Johnson spoke to a Sky News reporter a short time after the meeting ended. Here's what Johnson had to say.
The weekend, you said you were an incredible Hulk, sort of indomitable, strong-willed character. You just got a lively reception here from the Luxembourgers and then cancelled your press conference.
Well, right. I don't think it would have been fair to the Prime Minister of Luxembourg to... I think there was clearly going to be a lot of noise, and I think our points might have been drowned out, but I'm happy to talk to you now.
The European Union has been saying for months now it wants concrete proposals from the UK. You've spent 2 hours face-to-face with Jean-Claude Juncker. What concrete proposals have you put on the table?
Well, over the last couple...
Good question. What proposals, in place of the backstop, which is unnecessary anyway, have you put to the Commission?
Couple of weeks, there's been a lot of work.
There's been a lot of work. So he's going to tell lies now.
Papers have been...
Discussions. Answer the question.
Shared, but we are now in the stage where we have to start really accelerating the work, and that was the agreement today.
So the agreement today was that we'll accelerate the work. So you didn't then answer the question, which was, did you put a proposal to them about an alternative to the backstop? No, we just asked them, could we speed up the work?
With Jean-Claude Juncker and with Michel Barnier. And look, I don't want to get people's, you know, we've got to manage this carefully.
I don't want to get people's hopes up. It's what he nearly said. Because we ain't leaving with no deal. You better believe it.
Yes, there is a good chance of a deal. Yes, I can see the shape of it. Everybody can see roughly what could be done. But it will require movement, and it will require the system by which the EU can control the UK after we leave, the so-called backstop, to go from that treaty, and that needs to happen. So that's a big change that we need to get done. But if we
now, the interviewer should stop him there and return him to the original question, which is, did you make a proposal about the backstop to Juncker, Drunker and his pals, or did he just waffle on over a few cognacs and a nice bit of three course, a nice bit of dinner at the working lunch? What did you do? Did you just get pissed and laugh and take the mickey, or did you actually put a proposal to him?
But if we can get that done, as I've said before, then we're at the races, and I think we've got actually just the right amount of time to do a deal between now and the 17th, 18th of October. But as I never tire of telling you, if we can't do a deal by then, and obviously we want to work very hard to do it, if we can't do it by then we'll make sure that we can come out on the 31st of October, deal or no deal.
There are, as you know, Europeans who say that the backstop is sacred. It's too late to renegotiate it, and that these talks are a sham, that you just deal.
Well, I don't know who you've been talking to, but that's not what our interlocutors at EU heads of government level think at all.
Bollocks, they've said it about 1,000 times today. The backstop is irreplaceable, it can't be moved. Bollocks. You see, David Cameron has said, or is in the process of releasing his memoirs. They're being serialised in the UK press, and Cameron has basically sold this guy down the river as who he really is. Remember, Johnson voted for May's wretched deal in the end, right? Johnson is no Brexiteer, really. He made a political decision to support Brexit because the wind was blowing that way, or so he thought. He's not really committed to leaving. And this is utter nonsense. All of them, all the tyrants in the Commission, they've all said it 1,000 times today. No movement on the backstop. This guy's a clown. He's come here with nothing, basically. Right? Right. Of course, a real Brexiteer would stick their middle fingers up at them and say, right, that's it, we're gone. You go and explain it now to Mercedes-Benz and all the other companies in Europe that we're going to put tariffs on their goods coming in. Anyway, what else did Johnson say?
They know that we're all working very hard to get a deal. And that goes for our friends in Berlin or in Paris or in Dublin.
Yeah, he's just talking through his arse, right? That's Johnson. So the meeting took place in Luxembourg. Johnson and EU Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker, but also present at the meeting was Luxembourg's Prime Minister, called Xavier Bettel, or Bettel, Xavier Bettel. I know, I didn't think Luxembourg was big enough to have a Prime Minister. Salford is bigger than Luxembourg, I think. Is it? Is it? Greater Manchester is bigger than Luxembourg. But anyway, what a character this guy is, the Prime Minister of Luxembourg, Xavier Bettel, or Bettel. What a character. He's famous for being the first openly gay politician to be re-elected to the top job in his country. No other country has seen an openly gay politician be re-elected to the top job. I bet you Leo Varadkar in Ireland is properly cheesed off about that. But anyway, that's why he's famous. And he was supposed to present a joint press conference with Johnson after the meeting. So you had a lectern there, you had Xavier Bettel, and Johnson was supposed to stand alongside him to field questions. But Johnson pulled out of it. And I'm going to give Johnson a little bit of leeway here. I think he was right to pull out of it, because there were loads of protesters there. Now, how they got in is anyone's guess, but they were surrounding the podium where the press conference was due to take place. And I reckon somebody paid a crowd to come along to jeer Boris Johnson while he was standing alongside the pro-European Union Prime Minister of Luxembourg. I really do believe that. And Johnson is, whatever else he is, he's not that stupid. So he didn't. He swerved the press conference. But this Xavier Bettel, the Luxembourg PM, he stood there by himself anyway. Very theatrical guy, very festive. Very festive. Here's a couple of snippets of what he had to say to the assembled media and the protesters.
If they want that we are able to discuss about anything, we need it on the written side. But for the moment, I just have one written deal. I repeat, this Brexit, it's not my choice. It's been a decision from a party. It was a decision from David Cameron to do it. They decide. They decide. I deeply regret it. But don't put the blame on us, because now they don't know how to get out of this situation they put themselves in.
Calm down now, pal. You're the Prime Minister of Luxembourg. You don't matter a fuck to anybody. Luxembourg. I reckon Stockport could invade Luxembourg and successfully sack the government there. Anyway, it gets even better. This guy really knows how to play to the gallery. The Luxembourg PM, Xavier Bettel.
Now we speak about theatre. Yesterday, as I said, someone spoke about Hulk.
The Hulk.
I think it's too serious matter to speak about actors and about a script. The fact is, some people would love to give the blame to another and not being responsible for the situation. Again, one party, the Conservative Party, decided to organise that referendum. First, a clear information campaign, from my point of view, was not organised in the UK with all the risks of a referendum and of a Brexit. The third thing is, now people try to blame the others because we cannot find an agreement. We did not decide to organise that Brexit. It is a unilateral decision of the UK government. We have to accept the result, but it's not now on an unilateral way that UK government will decide what will be the next relations with the EU. We sit around the table, we have a withdrawal agreement, and this withdrawal agreement has been accepted by UK government. I just want to repeat and to remind that Theresa May accepted the withdrawal agreement. So don't make it like the European Union would be the bad guy not accepting decisions that the UK proposes. They accepted them, and it's not under my responsibility if they're not able to find a United Kingdom back in London and in the House of Commons and a majority.
Yeah.
These are homemade problems, and we have now all to deal with that homemade problems who makes all ourselves in a more general problem. So I won't accept any time.
He won't accept now. The Prime Minister of Luxembourg. We're in a bad place when we're getting threatened by Luxembourg, right?
Any time to be responsible as European leader, neither the Commission nor the 27 other countries for, I'm sorry, the mess we are in for the moment. Thank you.
And then he stormed off. He stormed off like Elton John. This little guy from Luxembourg. Oh, Jesus, eh? 17 minutes past the hour. It's just getting more and more surreal as the days go on. Over the weekend, the Liberal Democrats held their conference in Bournemouth. Their leader is Joe Swinson, Iokanu, We're surrounded by Scottish politicians, aren't we? Aren't we, William? She's brutal, brutal, is Jo Swinson. Anyhow, at the conference, the conference voted to cancel Brexit if the Lib Dems were to win a majority in the next election, which is not going to happen. Basically, the Lib Dems say, if we form the next government by ourselves, we will revoke Article 50 before any referendum. Well, Jo Swinson sat down with Sky News political editor Beth Rigby, political editor to give her a proper title, and it was interesting. Jo Swinson, so the Lib Dems saying, if we get elected, we'll cancel Brexit immediately, before any referendum. Sod the 17.4 million people, so she had a conversation with Sky's political editor, Beth Rigby.
I want to keep us in the EU, and I want to build a liberal society that is open, fair and inclusive. So absolutely, I want to win a majority and be Prime Minister and stop Brexit.
There is a legitimacy question in all of this. Let's just say that the Liberal Democrats won a majority at the next election. Let's just put that out there as an idea. In 2015, David Cameron won a general election. He won 37% of the popular vote. He won 11 million votes from the public, and that gave him, you could argue, a mandate. If you won, you would be prepared to win on that level of votes, perhaps, but over the turn, 17.4 million votes in a referendum. It's anti-democratic, Jo Swinson.
What?
It is anti-democratic, Jo Swinson. Good stuff, Beth.
Well, I think if we win a majority in Parliament...
ignore the 17.4 million.
Answer the question. Nurse Ratched, answer the question. So you're just going to get in and say to 17.4 million people, to hell with you and to hell with that democracy.
If we win a majority in Parliament on the very clear position of stopping Brexit, then that will be a mandate to do that. Now, I want to change our voting system, Beth. You know that. I think that we should have a different voting system.
But let's just go back to the principle.
But this is the system that we have. And incidentally, it's a system that does not make it easy for third parties to break through. And so if we are able to achieve that, which I do believe is possible because of the strength of feeling on these issues in the country, if we do that, then I think people will expect us to fulfil what we've said we would do in that election campaign.
But do you accept the 17.4 million people who voted to leave the EU in 2016, that you coming in and saying, I'm now going to overturn the result of that referendum, that is anti-democratic. There's no other way of putting it.
I fundamentally disagree.
It doesn't matter whether you fucking fundamentally disagree or not. It's a fact. It's a fact. You can't call yourself a Democrat if you suggest that, well, we'll come into government, the first thing we'll do is we'll stop Brexit. We'll forget the fact that we had the greatest ever turnout in UK electoral history, ever, on a single issue, and 17.4 million people, 52% of those who came out voted to leave the European Union. You're not fundamentally disagreeing, you are wrong. End of story.
I disagree. Democracy did not end on the 23rd of June 2016. I've spoken to plenty...
Democracy doesn't end, so we'll just keep asking the question until you give us the answer we want.
...plenty of people who have changed their mind since that time. There are plenty...
Name them. I'd be really childish if I was Beth Rigby now. I'd start asking her to name them. Can you name them? Some of your constituents, do you even know their names? Who are these people who said they've changed their mind?
Plenty of people who did not have a say in that referendum.
Now she's talking about the children, because won't somebody please think of the children... She's now going to talk about those who weren't eligible to vote in 2016. As if that fucking matters. It doesn't matter. If they were 15 at the time or 16, it doesn't matter a damn. Tough shit, Paddy. That's the way it goes, right? So here we go with the young ones, because we're ruining it for the young.
Random, and who are now able to vote, who are in our society, who are adults and part of our community. So... You know, it's not as if that is set in aspect forever.
Fuck off, love. Come on, Beth.
Swinson, there are also 17.4 million people that did have their say, that voted to leave. Over 3 years later, we still haven't left. And now you are saying, actually, I'm going to revoke. I'm not going to do it at all. I mean, and then you're a Liberal Democrat. Well, you're a Democrat. That's anti-democratic.
No, it's about giving people the choice and standing up.
Keep giving them the choice until they give you the answer you want. We've seen this before, not only in Ireland, but in France, in Holland. This is how it works. You decide to leave the fucking tyrannical, anti-democratic European Union because you can see through it. And the powers, the hidden hand, the banksters come together and say, no, you'll never fucking leave. We'll delay, 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 delay. And you'll get so tired of it in the end that when you have your second referendum, not most, but many of those who voted to leave first time around, they're not stupid. They know it's not going to happen, so they don't come out and vote second time around. We've seen it before, time and time and time again. Joe Swinson, leader of the Liberal Democrats, will give the last word on that to Susanna Reid, who co-hosts Good Morning Britain even with Piers Morgan. She interviewed Joe Swinson also, because Swinson did the rounds of the TV and radio shows this morning. She was on with Susanna Reid on Good Morning Britain, and Susanna Reid, to her credit, sums it right up. Here she is.
But your name is the Liberal Democrats. I mean, Democrats is literally part of your name, not part of any other party's name. It's part of your name. And you are saying you're not going to respect the democratic vote of the people, not even by saying, actually, before we revoke Article 50, we would have a second referendum. You're just going to cancel the democratic vote.
That's it, Susanna Reid. Last word on Brexit today. No more Brexit today, although maybe I get into it a little bit with Ryan Dawson. I asked him for the Japanese angle on Brexit. Very briefly, we talked about other things we did. We talked about Saudi Arabia, Iran, oil, the claims by Donald Trump and Mike Pompeo. We talked about lots. We talked about Epstein. Very interesting. And that's coming up in about 10 minutes' time. Ryan Dawson, I recorded him earlier on. Nice to do that for a change. Now, I've talked to you before about infomercials masquerading as news. And Sky News has, well, they've really raised the bar with this in terms of pushing big pharmaceutical companies and pushing the policies of the World Health Organization. Today was, well, it was as blatant, I think, as I've ever seen it. And I try not to be melodramatic. I try not to exaggerate. I try not to. Maybe I do sometimes. But this is Sky, I mean, this is crazy to me, having grown up, but my background, of course, being in radio production. And to see this in front of your eyes, well, it's kind of, it's surreal to me. Surreal is the right word. Sky has been reporting all day long on its website, but also on its programmes. All day long, Sky News, that is, that a meningitis charity is calling for better support for survivors of the disease. I'm going to read you a little bit from Sky's website before we hear some of the programme. The Meningitis Research Foundation, or MRF, is also campaigning for greater awareness of the condition and its long-term after effects. The group commissioned a survey to coincide with Meningitis Awareness Week, which shows how little people know about the disease. According to the report, nearly 55% of those surveyed didn't know meningitis can cause blindness. Nearly 65% didn't know that depression or anxiety can be as a result of meningitis. Nearly 80% did not know about tinnitus. Nearly 70% didn't know about memory loss. And over 70% didn't know meningitis can cause learning difficulties. Right? Right. Remember, Sky is writing on its website that the Meningitis Research Foundation commissioned a survey. And they've been running this all day long. So they're playing a little film, and the film is of a boy and his mother, and the boy apparently nearly died of meningitis. And if they had some awareness, and if the boy had the vaccine, well, that would have spared all and sundry all the misery. Even though the boy is fine now, he's doing well. So I'm going to spare you the mum and the son bit of the film. We'll skip to the end of the Sky News report. This is running big style today on Sky News, live programming and on their website. Meningitis awareness and how it's very serious. Listen to this and listen carefully to the report and what is said.
The Meningitis Research Foundation estimates there are nearly 2,500 UK cases of bacterial meningitis and meningococcal disease every year. 1 in 10 people die, 1 in 5 are left with severe impairments, and a third of survivors have long-term complications. Yet nearly 55% of those surveyed didn't know that meningitis can lead to blindness. Around 65% were unaware that depression or anxiety can also be a symptom, and over 70% didn't know that meningitis can cause learning difficulties. The research was commissioned for Meningitis Awareness Week, a campaign with extra significance because of what the charity see as a worrying decline in the number of babies under one who are being vaccinated against the disease.
What we know in the UK is that in general, vaccine rate and uptake is pretty good. It can be higher. What we've highlighted that in the last couple of years has been some confusion about the communication with GPs and some of the systems of the communications with GPs that hasn't helped at all, as well as some anti-vaccine messages.
Come on then, goodbye.
Matthew was lucky, surviving an illness that could have killed him within 4 hours.
But it didn't kill him. Now, he's mentioned the Meningitis Research Foundation has commissioned the study or the survey. This was mentioned in the intro and it's mentioned on Sky News, but that's the only information they give you about the survey. Keep it in mind.
Within 4 hours. Now his family and thousands like them are hoping that an increased awareness of the disease and its after effects could help significantly improve meningitis outcomes. Fraser Maud, Sky News, Withensea.
Well, the Paralympic rugby player Aaron Phipps contracted meningitis C aged 15. 3 months later, both of his legs and most of his fingers were amputated. He wants more people to know about the dangers of meningitis. Aaron and Dr. Philip Cruz join me now. Gentlemen, lovely to see you both. Thank you for joining us today.
Jesus Christ. Right, we'll hear Aaron, the Paralympic rugby player, and Dr. Philip Cruz in a second. He just described the horrific injuries this man had when he contracted meningitis in his teens. Horrific. He lost his legs and he had some of his fingers and toes amputated. I want you to keep in mind that the Sky News presenter said Dr. Philip Cruz and didn't expand on who Dr. Philip Cruz is and where he practices medicine. Like I said, Aaron has a horrible story. Listen to this.
Lovely to see you both. Thank you for joining us today. Aaron, I mean, you contracted meningitis back in 1999. Tell us what happened.
It was the first day back to school after the Christmas holidays. I was 15 years old. I got in from school and told my parents I didn't feel very well. Mm. I had a fever, but it was January. There was lots of flu around. You didn't think anything of it. I went up and got into bed and I vomited twice in the night. Woke up in the morning and my dad asked me how I was. I said I didn't feel great. Mm. Collapsed on the landing upstairs. So my dad scooped me up, put me in my parents' bed. My mum saw a rash appearing on my chest just here. So she did the glass test and the rash didn't disappear. So they thought it was potentially meningitis. So they called out a doctor who called out an ambulance. So my very first symptoms to life support machine was 12 hours. But from the rash to ICU was only 60 minutes.
My goodness. And at what point did you know and did your family know that you were going to lose both your legs and most of your fingers?
I was in intensive care for a month. For the first 2 weeks, I was in an induced coma. Mm. And at first, the news was broke to me that it might be the very tips of my fingers and my toes. And then they broke the news to me that it was going to be my feet as well. And I was 15, you know, all the emotion that goes with being 15 anyway. Everything's up in the air. And to get that news at that time was incredibly tough.
I'm guessing as a 15-year-old, you have known very little about meningitis and its effects on a person.
Yeah, indeed. I'm really fortunate my mum knew some of the symptoms because if she didn't, it could have been a very different story.
Mm. Dr. Cruz, I mean, I guess that's the point, isn't it? For so many people, you don't know about meningitis up until it happens to you or somebody that you love.
And that's a horrendous story from Aaron, the Paralympic athlete. Dreadful. Heaven help him. Dreadful stuff. So Sky has been doing that. They've been running the report about meningitis and awareness. And then they've been telling horror stories like Aaron's. And again, genuine sympathy for anybody who goes through that. Right. So the presenter brings in Dr. Cruz, and again, he doesn't mention who he works for verbally, although they put his title on the screen. What does Dr. Philip Cruz think then?
Exactly, and that's what we're after. It's all about the awareness. Mm. And this study commissioned by GSK shows that fewer than half of the parents that we surveyed do really talk about health topics with their teenagers. So it's really a matter of concern to just have that time, have that discussion on health topics. Are their vaccination schedules up to date? Mm. So, you know, have all of these time to sit down with your teenagers, your children, and educate them.
Did you catch that? What did Dr. Philip Cruz say at the beginning of his answer again?
Mm. And this study commissioned by GSK.
What was that?
Mm. And this study commissioned by GSK.
Let's hear that one more time. What was that?
Mm. And this study commissioned by GSK.
Yeah.
What kind of fuckery is this?
Yeah. No mention of the survey or the study being conducted by GSK in the online story, and no mention of it by the Sky News presenter. GSK, of course, is GlaxoSmithKline, and Dr. Philip Cruz is, of course, the medical director of GlaxoSmithKline, which makes many, 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 many vaccines, Bexsero for meningitis B being one of them. They have other meningitis vaccines as well. Right? This is sick, right? This is sick, this is. I'd complain to Ofcom about this, but what's the point? I wouldn't get further than maybe a one or two line response from them. Absolutely sick. And it gets even sicker still. More from Dr. Cruz, the medical director of GlaxoSmithKline.
Yes, there are many types of meningitis, and there are types where there can be addressed by a vaccine, so there could be a protection against it. So parents need to be aware that they're not just one type that can address all of meningitis. There are many types, and speak to your healthcare professional, your nurse, your pharmacist, about the different types of vaccines that can afford this protection against those
types. Yeah, get some vaccines. Preferably get our vaccines, the ones that we manufacture. Let me just explain in three or four sentences what's happened there. The Meningitis Research Foundation has asked GlaxoSmithKline to do a survey on how aware people are of meningitis. This is massive pharmaceutical giant GlaxoSmithKline, by the way, which has more than a dog in the proverbial fight. You couldn't fucking make this up. Glaxo goes out and finds that not only does nobody have any clue that meningitis is around, but Glaxo tells us all of these horror stories about what could happen to you if you get the disease, and they bring people like Aaron on to talk about losing his legs, his fingers and his toes. Sky News, masquerading as a news organisation, neatly packages this all together as a fucking infomercial. And neglects to, or at least tries to, obfuscate and kind of keep hidden in plain sight, to be fair, but hidden, that the study was done by GSK, and we've got the medical director of GlaxoSmithKline sitting here on the sofa urging you to get the vaccine. It is fucking blatant. Let's go back to the very beginning. I can't keep calm talking about this. This is maddening. Let's go back to the very beginning and the Sky News recorded report before we heard the interview with Aaron and the doctor. How many cases of meningitis a year in the UK was that? Let's hear.
The Meningitis Research Foundation estimates there are nearly 2,500 UK cases of bacterial meningitis and meningococcal disease every year.
2,500 cases of bacterial meningitis and meningococcal disease every year. 2,500. Ah, okay, let me give you a few stats and a few facts. These are genuine. They're not just pulled out of thin air. I've got the research here. There are 66.04 million people living in the United Kingdom. Your chances, dear listener, at least the listeners in the UK, of getting bacterial meningitis or meningococcal disease are 0.003% in the population. 0.0037% of people in the UK will contract meningococcal disease or bacterial meningitis. Let me fucking say it again. Your chances of getting bacterial meningitis or meningococcal disease are 0.00378%. 26,610 people were killed or seriously injured on UK roads in a single year last year. That's June 2017 to June 2018. 26,600. So you are 10 times more likely to be killed or seriously injured on the UK's roads than you are of contracting meningococcal disease or bacterial meningitis. You're not going to fucking get it. 0.0037% of the population will get it. How many of those do you think end up like poor Aaron, missing their legs and losing their fingers and their toes? Well, let me tell you, it is almost it's a calculation that's almost impossible to do. It is in the hundreds of fucking millions to one. And yet Sky News, pretending to be a news organisation, will bring a GlaxoSmithKline medical fucking director onto their sofa. And a man, God love him, who when he was 15 lost his legs and his fingers and his toes. And a Glaxo guy will sit there and tell you to go and get your vaccinations and speak to your children and tell them to make sure that their vaccination schedule is up to date. This is fucking UK in 2019. I'm going to take some music when I come back. We'll be chatting. Or I'll be playing you that interview I recorded earlier on with Brian Dawson. Unbelievable on Sky News today. Not for the first time either, by the way. Here's Queen and Bowie. At least I think it's Queen and Bowie. I think Bowie is in this as well. There are several versions. I'll be back with more in a couple of minutes. Welcome to the Richie Allen Show for Monday, 16th of September 2019. And I am Richie Allen, of course. It's good to be with you. Right, Queen and Under Pressure on the Richie Allen Show. The time is exactly 17 and a half minutes to the top of the hour. Welcome to the programme. Thanks for choosing it. La Antenna says, it's been a while, I think. Are you seriously saying that GSK have yet to develop a road traffic collision vaccine? What are they messing around at? Yes, indeed. Hi to William in Scotland. Hi to Jason. Hi to Patrick Vidian, who says your chances of getting meningitis, etc., are so slow, but taking the vaccines might do for you at a much greater frequency, says Patrick there. How are you, Patrick? Hi to Susan as well, who says those who push the vaccines own the vaccines. This is extraordinary. You see, I do this so that you can take this information, even though it was a little bit ranty, you can take it and present it to other people. You don't need to play my audio. Present it to them. Look at this. Studies being commissioned by the Meningitis Research Foundation asking GSK to do the study on on meningitis awareness. Incredible. Then a medical director of GSK not being introduced as a medical director, not being properly introduced, because the Sky News presenter should of course said, well, GlaxoSmithKline did the survey on behalf of the Meningitis Research Foundation and the medical director of GSK joins us now. No, he didn't say that. And it's deliberate. It's deliberate that they don't include that in the introduction. Yes, Susan. Yes, those pushing the vaccines own the vaccines. And a useless, cretinous presenter is sitting there like an absolute moron and can't see what's happening. He's been shagged, rogered, fucking ridden on his own programme. 'Twould kill me if I was the presenter for one of these organisations and I had to be shafted like that on air. No, I'm sorry, I'm stopping this interview. You're recommending vaccines and your fucking company makes them. Really? Yeah, that's handy. Yeah. God, what were the chances that you were going to do a bit of research and find that people knew all about meningitis and they were all taking their vaccines? Come on. Oh, thanks for the tweets, by the way. Good to have you online today. Good to have you online. Let's hi to Paul Alawi as well. And if I missed anybody else, David Stanford, Studies Rehab, Joe Public, how you doing, Joe? Let's move on. Let's quickly move on and introduce Ryan Dawson. I met Ryan on TBV back in 2013. I did say that earlier on. ancreport.com. He's a really, really interesting guy. and he's a very good writer. He's also a very good filmmaker. You know, he's the man behind War by Deception, Decades of Deception, Syria, Israel's Invisible Hand, and The Emperor Unmasked, among many films. He was also made a Goodwill Ambassador for NARA Japan. He's a jiu-jitsu instructor, or he was in his time, and he writes, he broadcasts, and you can find all of his podcasts and radio shows on his own website, which is ancreport.com. That is ancreport.com. And because of the time zone, because of the difference, because at the moment he's 8 hours ahead of us in Japan, we decided to pre-record a conversation this morning. I really enjoyed it. I think you might as well. This is me with Ryan Dawson, recorded a bit earlier on. Keep the tweets coming in, because when you hear this at the end of it, I'll come back and read your tweets. Me with Ryan Dawson, today, Monday, September 16th, 2019. Ryan Dawson, it's an absolute pleasure to have you on from Japan. Thanks for coming on. How are you?
I'm good. It's been a long time since we've talked.
I know. It was back in 2013. You were fantastic. You came on to the, as I said, short-lived TPV and did a terrific segment with us. And you would have been asked back again and again, but we didn't kind of hang around for too long, sadly. But it's brilliant to have you back on your website.
That is something to discuss at some point, is censorship, because it's getting really... It's nuts. I mean, it's expanding more and more, and I think more people are seeing it. But I've faced it, you've faced it, and you know, it's getting up to even Democratic candidates for president are facing censorship from Google. Tulsi Gabbard's suing them, and we can see it. It's blatant, and I really feel like everyone ought to be afraid when you have these giant tech giants like Google that really can influence elections globally. It's not the Russians. It's big tech, and they decide what people can hear and what they won't hear, and that's influencing elections.
Let's get into that later on, for sure, because there's new information coming out here all the time and over the weekend about plans for independent media. Ryan, that's a hugely important topic. I'm fascinated to hear about what Tulsi Gabbard is doing. There's only one place to start today, though, and You're way ahead of everybody on this because of where you are. Well, because of you're a historian and you've been following this for years and years as well, to give you your absolute dues there. But you're ahead of us there in Japan. The Iranian government is being blamed for attacks on Saudi Arabian oil facilities over the weekend that have resulted in a dramatic increase in oil prices, all sorts of threats and accusations being made. And just before calling you today, Ryan, I've been listening to Sky News. Their correspondent, Mark Stone, I think it's Mark Jones or Mark Stone, he's in Jerusalem, and he reckons, and to be fair to him, even though he's a Sky News reporter, he's not one for melodrama, but he reckons we're getting very close to the brink here with these accusations and the seriousness of the escalation. How are you reading this?
My co-host and I have been talking about this for months, really. We were saying back when the first seizure of ships in the Strait of Hormuz, and then there, if you remember, there was a second seizure after that, and then a British ship was seized as a result. When they were playing games in the Strait of Hormuz, my co-host Andrew Illingworth, he's a military analyst, we were talking about how this scenario could play out, how it could escalate. And I think it was back in late April or early May, I did a spreadsheet on John Bolton and all the people who finance him, all the groups that finance them and what they are looking at. And there was a great report by Gareth Porter. I think it was on Jim Loeb's website. He writes for so many things. I can't remember which place I read it at. But he also had a breakdown of some of the same financiers of John Bolton. And by comparing notes, I was able to see in there this odd incidence of the Israelis meeting with a work group specifically to talk to Bolton, Pompeo, and their neocons are all around Trump. And in this, their main purpose was to escalate tensions with Iran, and they have a list of events that could happen. And in this list, they listed 8 things. And right after seizing ships was to provoke a response from Iran to hit Saudi oil fields. Now, that doesn't mean Iran did, but if they can get a Houthi drone in there or allow a Houthi drone in there. They're going to blame it on Iran. However, a response as far as attacking Iran goes, which would be insane, it would be more likely for it to be asymmetric and to hit Iranian troops in Syria, Abu Kamal, or a target like that is probably the most likely response from the U.S. because actually attacking Iranian oil fields like Pompeo wants to do would just cause Iran to actually shoot cruise missiles into Saudi Arabian oil fields, and then there would be nothing left. So I hope cooler heads will prevail, and thank whoever you believe in that John Bolton's gone, because he would have made this whole situation worse.
It's interesting. We'll talk about Bolton now in a second. It's interesting you say you don't see any attacks, airstrikes inside Iran. That's good. Maybe attacking Iran elsewhere like Syria. That makes a bit of sense to me at the moment. You mentioned John Bolton. I've been reading a number of sources over the weekend. I've been reading your website as well. By the way, folks, I know you know all about it, but ancreport.com. Get onto the website, bookmark it. Ryan Dawson is our guest. Ryan, the say it for me, I was going to say it there, Bolton. Charles Kupperman, now you know all about him. A lot of people probably won't because he was the Deputy National Security Advisor. He's taken the role since Bolton was dismissed, maybe temporarily. Some of your listeners and your readers, they might say, Ryan, why do you think that it's a good thing Bolton has gone? This guy Kupperman might just be as hawkish as Bolton. What do you think?
Well, it's just a temporary replacement. I mean, they're looking at, they say there's a list of about 10 names, but what I'm hearing from D.C. is there's really two names. And I'm pulling for McGregor, of course. Steve Bakken is another one, but they might keep him where he is on Korea policy. But, you know, I don't like the excuse where someone says, oh, well, some horrible person is gone and the horrible person under them took their place. I mean, getting rid of horrible people is getting rid of horrible people. And there really isn't anything worse than John Bolton, because John Bolton's tied to the American Enterprise Institute. He's tied to CEP. He's tied to the Gatestone Group in the UK, which is like the version of IAE over there. And Sheldon Adelson and all the neocons, all the Zionists, he was their man. If you remember, Bolton was the ambassador to the UN for Bush the Lesser. And he sounded like Nikki Haley with a mustache. It was like Israel gets two ambassadors and the U.S. has none.
Yeah, he's a dreadful human being, and he's a mass murderer. He's a psychopath. There's no, it isn't language becoming normally of professional radio presenters, but it's a fact. He is a lunatic.
He was John McCain level demonic. Yeah. I mean, there's a few group, if you were going to rank the neocons in nastiness, Bolton is up there with McCain and Richard Pearl and the worst of them.
Tell us about McGregor, this army colonel then, whom would be your, I suppose, maybe best of a bad bunch.
Well, I mean, yeah, I'd rather have like Ron Paul or something, but given the realistic choices, I mean, Douglas McGregor, I'll tell you the good things about him. At least he seems to genuinely want to end the war in Afghanistan and pull out of Iraq. Because those are two useless endeavors. We know that Afghanistan's protecting opium and fostering low-level conflict, which prevents any pipelines connecting to China. And we're not really fighting the Taliban. And obviously, we're not hunting bin Laden and his gang. We're aiding. Bin Laden's dead and has been for a long time. And we aid al-Qaeda in Syria and Libya and everywhere else. So there's no sincere fight against Islamic terrorism. So there's no reason to be in Afghanistan. It's a complete waste of money and has caused an opioid crisis, and they could come home. And Douglas McGregor is staunchly of the opinion of just pack up and leave, and then to get the U.S. out of Iraq. And isn't it about time to do that? Now, on some other things, he's kind of, you know, at least as bad as the run of the mill. But that's two major reasons for him to be in there, is to get out of two theaters of war, especially Afghanistan. That's a hot war. We're killing people every day. So that's a vast improvement over Bolton, the defective human product, as the North Koreans called him.
Absolutely. Let's stay.
He tabled that one too. I mean, that was Bolton again.
Let's stay just for a minute with the Saudi oil attack. One of the things we've been conditioned to do since September 11th, some of us, maybe your good self, I mean, it wasn't until post 9/11 really that I began to see things a bit differently and began to take my own career in a different direction. But yourself, I think you've been on to these people maybe longer than I have. We've learned to ask the old phrase, the old Latin, qui bono, who benefits. You know, you know better than anybody, there's an election looming in Israel. There was also speculation that Donald Trump was going to pull a North Korea and he was going to go and meet with the Iranian leaders. That's all gone out the window now, of course, with this alleged attack by Iran on the Saudi oil base facility, the Saudi oil field. So the skeptics, not skeptics, but those who are always on the case of Israel, now I am sometimes, but not all the time, they will say, well, Israel, more than anybody, has benefited from what happened over the weekend. What will you say?
Well, Netanyahu has been staunchly anti-Iran, whether there was an attack or not. I mean, their whole public is already in that camp. So it doesn't really add anything other than it exacerbates his threats, because they already tried to pull the trigger on Hezbollah and ended up losing a base. So that didn't work out very well. He has smeared Ehud Barak, his challenger, one of his challengers, with the Epstein affair. Ehud Barak has been seen going in and out of Rake Mansion in New York, and he was also on trips to the Caribbean, and he's also listed in Epstein's Black Book. But the Israeli public doesn't seem to matter. It doesn't, like, okay, so he's a child rapist. Meh. How many Palestinians will he kill? I mean, that's their bloodthirsty pack. It's a lunatic state, as Norman Finkelstein calls it.
It is a lunatic state, but to be fair to Barak, and I understand the passion of your argument, he hasn't been accused of or convicted of anything. I despise his politics. But, you know, to call him a child rapist might be a bit of a stretch at this point, maybe.
I can say he's in and out of Rape Mansion, and he protected child rapists, because when their diplomat to Brazil, Ari Scher, was moved by Barak out of Brazil back to Israel, and then they tried to push him into position in Australia when he was caught red-handed with George Steinhardt producing child pornography and as well as selling young kids as young as 8 and 9 years old to prominent businessmen for sex. And the reason they were busted is because in the background of some of these smut videos that they were illegally selling was the swimming pool of the Israeli consulate. And Ari Scher is a homosexual, by the way, so was the Hebrew language teacher he was partnered with, George Steinberger. And they were busted. And all that happened was he got shipped back to Israel. Ehud Barak protected him. Also, the president of Israel, while Barak was prime minister, was Moshe Katsav, who got convicted of rape. And that party and that clique, Barak is probably more in the role of like the Catholic Church and moving rapists around and making sure they don't go to prison. And then you see him visiting Epstein. And there isn't much else to do in the Caribbean as far as everyone else that's there. But he hasn't been convicted. Neither is Jesline Maxwell or Jean-Luc Brunel or a lot of these people. But what we did find is that a whole bunch of little kids got paid off millions of dollars in a settlement back when Epstein was arrested the first time. And why else do you pay a bunch of people who were, you know, 12, 14 at the time, millions of dollars?
Yeah, I'll give you that. Had a very interesting conversation last week on the show about Epstein and Ehud Barak. So tell us about let's
Barak also introduced the Black Cube to Harvey Weinstein, who's been raping people in Hollywood, ex-Mossad agents, to harass the victims of rape. So everybody around him is involved in this, and he's helping cover it up, taking money from Wexner and Epstein through the Wexner Foundation, as well as he's caught in a scandal with the Bronfman family, whose daughter has pleaded guilty to her role in the NXIVM scandal, also raping children.
So. Really, this is really important stuff, and a fascinating conversation last week with Christopher Bolin about this, and in recent weeks with journalists here in the UK who've been following Epstein's links to prominent people over here. Let's stay with him. Ryan Dawson is our guest. I know you know all about Ryan Dawson. ancreport.com. If you haven't come across Ryan before, check him out. He's an excellent podcast host. He's a writer, a journalist, a filmmaker, and he's been living in Japan for many years. I'd like to talk about that before we part company today as well, because it seems to me like a bit of a lunatic asylum from the outside looking in. So I'd love to talk to you about Japan and what it's like living over there. Thanks for coming on today.
I think we think the same thing looking outside. Everybody looks like a lunatic asylum.
That makes sense. That's right. That makes sense too. Ryan, let's stay with Jeffrey Epstein then. I know you've been following him. I'm reading ancreport.com. I'm reading your articles. I'm listening to your podcast. And also the interviews you do with other people around the world.
We released a lot of stuff in May. A lot of stuff. Before he got arrested, you know.
So who is this guy then? Who is he? The billionaire financier, mover and shaker. That's the official... Well, pre-accusations, pre-conviction, Jeffrey Epstein, you know, very powerful, very prominent man. With everything you've gathered, read, discussed, analysed, who the bloody hell was this man?
He had a couple roles. It seems like this is an Israeli operation, obviously. Everybody around him, his money is financed. He's financed by the Mega Group, which is the largest Zionist clique of Zionist billionaires that exists. It's worse than AIPAC. I mean, that's... It's the who's who's list of the most wealthy Zionists in the world. And, you know, and then he's got a team of lawyers that have also been consistently defending child rapists like Alan Dershowitz, defending Roman Polanski and others. And this guy, but his other role that we have more evidence on, actually, although I do believe the other shoe will drop on all the sexual escapades, was his role at Bear Stearns. And one of the things he did at Bear Stearns was during the mortgage-backed security crisis, Epstein helped create a SIV, which is a structured investment vehicle. It's creation of Citigroup, the one that invented this money laundering operation is essentially what it is. Bear Stearns created Bear Stearns in Dublin to get around U.S. regulations, yeah. And they created this company called Liquid Funding Ltd., and Liquid Funding Ltd. was 40% of the capital came from Epstein himself, and he was also the chairman of it. And this is while he's working for Bear Stearns. He set it up in Bermuda, and it worked as a structured investment vehicle to offset toxic assets that Bear Stearns had acquired through the subprime crisis. So essentially what that means in plain language is, when rating companies come and they look for solvency, or they look at it, see how, you know, how many debt obligations you have, how much capital you have, how much do you owe, and how much are you making? What Bear Stearns could do is take the debts off their books because they sold them all to Liquid Funding Ltd. They sold them to their own subsidiary,
to themselves,
really.
Yeah.
And yeah. So their book is clean because they've removed the debts and put them over on a different book. And then the rating agency, which they bribe, and the rating agencies know what they're doing, but they have plausible deniability because as they go and look, oh, it looks like you don't have debts, continue on. But what's really going on is it's kind of like a kid shoving all their toys under the bed and having their parents look at the room saying,
the room
see, it's all clean.
Yeah. That's but what they were doing. Yeah.
But eventually you run out of room under the bed and they all spill out everywhere. And so they kept selling these toxic assets because of the moral hazard where – the people lending didn't pay any consequences if those receiving the loans couldn't pay it back because they had already sold those securities to third parties. And so they just kept making more and more subprime, no collateral, no papers needed. They got suckered all these people into very bad agreements on housing, and most of them couldn't pay, of course. But a lot of this money, they made commercial paper, which is just It's like a loan shark with high interest loans, basically. You can use it only if you have the AAA rating and top tier status, which they got because they bribed the rating agencies. And the commercial paper ended up in money markets. Hundreds of millions of dollars went to Dreyfus Money Market, Frank Russell Investment, and J.P. Morgan market funds. And then, of course, everybody knows the end of the story. J.P. Morgan would buy Bear Stearns in a fire sale. But the senior loan didn't come from them. It came from this group called Maiden Lane that the Federal Reserve Bank of New York created. And so they floated $28.8 billion to J.P. Morgan Chase's $1.2 billion, which offset all the toxic assets that Epstein had at Liquid Funding. And so they all made bank. Another thing he did was he made a lot of money in hedge funds. And what these people have figured out, and this would take a really long time to explain with the nitty-gritty details and stuff, but the gist of it is what this is the game they were doing. A hedge fund is basically It's a type of mutual fund of investments that only very wealthy people get to participate in, only very qualified hoity-toity types. But it's very easy to almost ensure that your bundle of stocks are going to go up. Let's say, for a very simple example, if you bundle a bunch of weapons companies together, Lockheed Martin, Raytheon, and some logistical companies, Kellogg, Brown & Root, Halliburton, Bechtel, et cetera, and then you go pick a fight, obviously the war stocks go up when there's a war. And so if you have a hedge fund that's just a conglomeration of defense industries, then you're almost guaranteed that you're going to profit and all your buddies will profit. And they would do things like this where they had compromised individuals in the government through the sexual blackmail, bribery, et cetera. And they use state instruments to ensure that their hedge fund investments would procure profits, because they're using the state legal and regulatory power to get state contracts to the same companies they just invested in. And so it's a clear win.
It's
and
clear
that's
wanton
how these
criminality.
People are making so much money.
That's how they can steal so much money. And today of all days, you would imagine some of these companies, these arms manufacturing companies, logistical companies, Bechtel and the others, and you mentioned Raytheon, Lockheed Martin, their stocks will definitely take a boost today, won't they? I mean, they will, in light of what happened in Saudi Arabia.
I mean, and, you know, trading opens Monday morning. What time is it in the US now? I don't know, like 6 something.
Yeah, you're right. It's 6 a.m. on Wall Street. Yeah, just about 6 a.m. Right. So just in a few minutes time, yeah.
Well, it hasn't even opened yet. So we haven't even seen, we've already seen some impact in Saudi Arabia. And we know which direction the speculation is going to go.
Yeah, yeah.
But also they're looking there, they're kind of rubbing their hands. Because they're saying whether you can increase the attacks on Yemen, or, in my opinion, an asymmetrical strike on Iranian targets in Syria, also with a threat of, well, maybe they're crazy enough to hit Iran, you know. As long as people think that other people think that they're going to invest more in weapons companies, then it'll go up regardless, whether it's psychological or real world. If everybody moves in the same direction and they sort of make it happen, you know what I mean?
Yeah, and now more than ever, sorry to interrupt you, now more than ever. I mean, the words of prime ministers and presidents have always affected the markets forever. But now more than ever, with the advent of Twitter and Facebook, I mean, we have the man in the White House tweeting out at 3-4 o'clock in the morning, sometimes tweeting aggressive, threatening things sometimes, whether he's serious or not, definitely have an impact on the market. And I'm, you know, call me a conspiracy theorist. I wonder how often Trump has left somebody else in on the fact that he's going to have a wild swipe at somebody on Twitter. Because the wild swipe might move a market in one direction. You know, I'd like to be Donald Trump's best friend, to be honest. I'd like to know, what are you going to say tomorrow morning at 2 o'clock? And based on what you're going to say from your bedroom, I'm going to have a bit of speculating on the old stock market. These are crazy times, these.
He's been pretty coy, because Donald Trump said he's going to allow Saudi Arabia to determine who attacked them. And so far, I mean, the Houthis have claimed that they did it themselves. They're admitting they attacked them. It was a drone strike. We said this was possible. We've been saying it for months. And it's not out of the blue. Everyone needs to understand Saudi Arabia has been bombing Yemen since 2015, really since 2011, officially. At first, there was this BS about, oh, the U.S. is using drones to hit ISIS in Yemen, except it's not really ISIS. And, oh, we accidentally bombed this and that. It's a cyclical thing. They've really been attacking them since the 60s on and off. And so, just like Israel, it's been attacking Palestine since the 40s on and off. And so, it's nothing new. So, for Yemen to do this isn't a surprise, unless you have your head in the sand.
Yeah.
Or for Yemen to be motivated to do this. Yet, everyone's blaming Iran. And they'll say things like, well, how could Yemen, the Houthis, get hold of these drones or build this and that? And they're really underestimating the... This is the best thing ever, and this is from journalists I've talked to in Yemen. They really underestimate black markets, because it's not Iran smuggling in the weapons. It's mostly Saudi weaponry that they used U.S. money to buy that are being sold on the Saudi black market to Yemen for personal profit. Yeah. So Yemen is using guns it's buying from its own enemy, from its own enemy, to attack Saudi Arabia. But, you know, the Saudi public isn't uniform. They don't really see eye to eye with the royals or the Endeavor. I mean, if you ask people exactly what is Saudi Arabia's motivation in Yemen, why are they at war with Yemen? They couldn't tell you.
They wouldn't be able to articulate an answer, and that wouldn't surprise me, Ryan. Ryan Dawson is our guest, ancreport.com. Check out Ryan's podcast. If he is new to you, I know most of my audience will be very familiar with Ryan's work in Japan there. It is excellent. I can't recommend it highly enough. Check it out, ancreport.com.
Probably everyone's seen the 9/11 work,
Well, no doubt, yeah. And obviously, I mean, we could get into that in a few minutes as well, because we're only a few days since the anniversary. Where do you think then, I know it's a $64 million question, where do you think this is all inevitably leading? Is it inevitably leading to, whether it's 2020, 2021, an inevitable military clash, if not just in Yemen and in Syria, but maybe airstrikes inside Iran? I believe in my heart that's what the hawks in Israel would like. I believe
absolutely what they want.
What they want, yeah. And who's gonna win that then? I mean, where is it gonna go? It sounds to me, Ryan, like you still
usually
are.
They do. They usually do. Israel wins those arguments. But with Bolton was just fired, Trump was so close to, because he's looking at the reality of the situation. Okay, the U.S. can invade Iran if it wants to lose 10,000 people and cause a global economic crisis, because Iran cannot militarily defeat the United States. But I'll tell you what they can do and what they would do. First, they'll close the Strait of Hormuz. That ends oil from Qatar, Bahrain, Saudi Arabia, and the UAE. That's a global shutdown on oil. Secondly, they'd fire everything they have into the Saudi oil fields, and then that would be the end of that. And so it's kind of like, yeah, you can invade Iran, but you're shooting yourself in the foot. So that's really not an option. That's why they've been trying proxy wars with MEK, Arab Separatists, Jandala, Stuxnet, assassinating scientists, shooting people in parades. They've played every move they have. And Iran has been able to absorb and resist this since 1979. And so are they going to keep on keeping on, or are you going to look at real politics? Because there's a lot of pressure from the French, even as bad as Macron is. He's facing yellow vest protests, and the what really put it over the top was what? Prices on oil, which increased because they're not allowed to buy from Iran because Trump unilaterally left the Iran deal. There's a lot of pressure from Asia. The Israeli lobby is not the all-powerful being it used to be. They're starting to lose some of their power. It's starting to slip. And it's kind of a cyclical event with these people. About every 70 years or so, they finish sawing the branch they're sitting on. Oil is needed. Iran has a lot, and a lot of countries that want to buy it from them, and they're already making backdoor deals to get around the U.S. policy there. And Trump is kind of seeing it as, look, I either abandon all of Europe and Asia just for Israel's sake, or maybe I need to get them to cool down a little bit. He was willing to talk. He can't do that now, but I don't think he can go to war either. So the most natural response is what I said earlier. He'll probably try to use proxy forces in Syria to attack Iran there and save some face, but stop short of a war, because Trump basically has 2020 in the bag unless he does something really stupid, because all his competition live in clown world. They're talking about extending free health care to illegal aliens, birthday abortions. It's just a nonstop stupidity.
It's his madness, isn't it? I mean, we see
like
that
they make
here.
Trump yeah. look sane by comparison.
By comparison.
So he doesn't have to do anything. But if he starts a war with Iran or something like that, that could spin everything around quick.
Ryan, thanks for that. I mean, you said Trump was willing to talk with Iran. He can't do it now. That's why, I mean, I've never been one of those presenters. I don't make claims that I can't substantiate. And I certainly don't spend all of the time I've got on this program blaming Israel for everything. I certainly do not. But it's that very thing that Trump's planned chat with the Iranians or some sort of surprise. I thought there was some sort of surprise visit coming. Maybe not to Iran itself, obviously, but to some nearby country. I thought something was going to happen. It can't now, as you said, and That's why I wonder about the timing of the attack in Saudi Arabia. But look, we've covered a lot of that. Ryan Dawson is our guest. It's ancreport.com. Give me a laugh then. Give me the Japanese take on Brexit. Boris Johnson, the UK Prime Minister, is going to is going to meet with the European Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker today. Johnson swears by God and sonny Jesus that the UK will leave the European Union on October 31st. He's lost four very serious votes in a row in the UK Parliament. That has actually been taken out of his hands, allegedly. I think there'll be a couple of court battles before we even get to the middle of October. I've always been a committed Brexiteer. As an Irishman, my country voted twice against terrible treaties, which gave more power fiscally and politically to Brussels, the Lisbon Treaty and the Nice Treaty. Each time, of course, the European Union told the Irish, as a little old Irish us, they said, go back and vote again until you give us the right answer. I despise the European Union and what it does, but I'm open to, you know, I like to speak to people who are Remainers. I'll speak to anybody. What do you make of this mess,
Ryan? The EU is exactly as it's spelled.
Ooh, yeah, it's dreadful, yeah.
It's about right.
In every sense of the word.
To get the Japanese perspective of Brexit, I think Japan and Britain are quite similar as far as being island nations, expansionist, both first world countries. Japan a little bigger, a little wealthier, but the Japanese cannot understand for the life of them how Britain got itself in this situation in the first place. Japan has free trade, but it doesn't have free movement of people and things. It's got very strict immigration to make Japan Japanese, because if they didn't, it would be Chinese overnight, obviously.
Yeah.
There wouldn't be a Japan anymore. And yeah, I was recently in London and some people got on my case about this because I was complaining. I was like, I want to see more authentic European stuff. And it was, I felt like I had landed in the Middle East. And there's nothing wrong with the Middle East. I defend the Middle East every day. But I'm not in the Middle East. I was in the capital
in London, yeah,
of Britain. And I would be very sad if I went to a capital city in the Middle East and it was a bunch of white guys selling cheeseburgers and pizza. Right? It would be like, wait, where's the Middle East stuff?
Yeah. You know?
And that's how I felt in London. It was just, you know, Islamabad or whatever. I couldn't get bacon in this one place. My people yelled at my baby. I saw, you know, just, I don't like seeing like women have to walk behind a man and stuff. That's against my values. You know, I'm like, y'all do what you want to do. But in London, it just, there's no assimilation. There's Brexit, or not Brexit, the lack of Brexit, joining the EU, which allows the free flow of people and goods. You're getting shafted economically and you're getting cultural suicide. You're not getting the best and brightest from these places. You're getting mostly benefit seekers. And I have the utmost sympathy for actual war refugees. But let's be serious. That's a very small percentage of people flooding the European nations. And of course, I'm all for not having these wars in the first place, or the predatory lending, or any of the things that exacerbate the situation. But this idea that you can smush a bunch of different languages together, a bunch of different cultures together into a union is nonsense. It's hard enough even with the common language and culture of the United States to keep the glue together. And so it just doesn't work. You don't have a common culture or even language, and you can't have this sort of – it's never going to be even-handed. There's always regional scapegoating. Look at Greece and Germany. You know, there's not equal partnership. And the EU is scared to death because if Britain leaves, who's going to make up for all the money that the UK pumps in? I think they're like second or third. I think Germany, France, and the UK, around the same as France.
You're right.
They don't have the capital from anywhere. What are they, is Germany going to foot the bill? They can't do it. And so they're desperate to hold on. And they use the most ridiculous arguments. Oh, people pro Brexit are just a bunch of Nazis or whatever.
Yeah.
that's
little
that's
Englanders.
Terrible.
Little. Do you know? I don't believe for a minute that we will leave. I did a special the day after the referendum. I don't vote in elections, and I know you might want to give me a smack for saying that. Maybe you don't. I don't know. I don't. I gave up years ago because the system only works, only serves to put controlled and owned people into power. So ultimately, it doesn't really matter. I think Epstein might prove that. I think his legacy will be to prove that you never have any chance when you go to the ballot box, because whomever gets in whether we're talking about a party or whether we're talking about a single
person.
Usually
by the primaries, it's all compromised candidates already.
It's the same here, Ryan. It doesn't matter. It's the same here, you know, when you look at our governments. So I don't believe we will ever be allowed to leave. I despise David Cameron, the former UK Prime Minister, but I do believe that he is telling the truth in his memoirs that none of these people are committed leavers. Boris Johnson is not a committed leaver of the European Union. I reckon what's going to happen is...
Well, wasn't he on the other side up until recently? I mean,
all his
he
life,
was completely anti-Brexit and now suddenly... But see, you got to be careful. Okay, if you leave the European Union, then what? Because if you just end up back into the sphere of American and Israelis, that's not any better. It's out of the pot into the kettle kind of thing.
100%
you need
right.
You need to have sovereignty for Britain independently and not just be part of this clique or this other clique. Otherwise, it's a useless endeavor. I think Nigel Farage is the only one really serious about it. Johnson is, BJ, as we call him. Tony Blair, we call TB.
Well, he was as toxic and as infectious as TB. Blair, who's still around banging the drum for the European Union. It staggers
and
me.
And he's on Epstein's black book.
Blair is in the book, right?
They found someone desperate enough to touch that thing.
You have, and that brings us back around.
He has a very weird looking face. I'm sorry, he's got like Ted Cruz level strange with those ears and those teeth and stuff.
He looks ill, doesn't he? I have this thing. Looking at some of these people, the real warmongers, the real murderers, the ones who are in retirement now, it's not because I want them to look ill, it's not my projection. They look ill, Ryan. They look seriously ill.
If you know people who, artists that draw caricatures, if Tony Blair sat down, they would just be like, just draw his real face. You don't have to do anything.
He looks like the man looks like he's in turmoil. You've got to be. I don't care how rotten you are. You can't go to bed at night and not see the demons in the distance, having done what these people did in Iraq and in Afghanistan and in Libya and elsewhere.
And then continue to justify it after the fact. I hope it eats at them. You can see them age very fast. But some of these psychopaths, it doesn't. I mean, if you look at Yemen's a good example, or Libya, or you look at these children starving to death, innocent babies, all these kids with nothing to eat, their ribs poking out of their bodies, and you just think, how can you put a blockade on food? Why don't let that in? No one's going to throw bananas at you. Like, let the food in, dang it. And it doesn't bother them. I mean, Abu Ghraib in Iraq, they sodomized children over and over again, recorded it, and played the tape for their mothers, some of whom committed suicide. There was a state policy of torturing and raping kids. That was played for part of the U.S. Congress, too. They got to hear the audio of it, of these kids screaming and being sodomized and humiliated, emasculated. The whole Congress didn't get to hear it, but McCain and people like that heard it. John Kerry heard it. Nothing. Nothing changed for them. They're still just as pro-war as ever. So when you say, just got to eat at them at night, you're coming at that from the perspective of a normal human being who has compassion and just like in a shred of humanity even. They don't. These neocons, like, it's talking about caricatures. They almost have the face of like the goblins and trolls and like creatures of evil from fairy tales. That are always obsessed with gold and coming after your children in the night or whatever. That pretty much sums up the Epsteins of the world. They were obsessed with money and preyed on children, except it's real life. It's not a fairy tale. And the way they acquired money was always through fraud and theft and bribery to stay out of it. And they compromised people from Dennis Hastert, who was the Speaker of the House, the highest position in Congress in the United States, who was raping young boys. And then we had the Deborah Jean Palfrey affair, the DC Madame, which may link to Epstein now, we're starting to find out. Huge inside ring of all these prominent business people and politicians that are involved in messing around with little kids or at minimal extramarital affairs. And it makes you wonder, like, how did it get so degenerate? Like, I never knew that pedophilia was – I guess when I was growing up, that was like cannibalism to me. Like, who would do that? You know, that's such a rare weirdo. It's – no, it's way more people than we ever knew.
It's like a currency, isn't it, with these people?
Yeah, it's like – it's hard for us well-adjusted, sane people – with compassion and empathy to imagine how anyone can be so cold and disgusting and degenerate and to do things to children or to babies even. And this, that has happened. And yet the Israeli public, I mean, cheers as their snipers shoot children in the balls, and they have more children incarcerated than anywhere in the world.
Are we being a bit unfair there now to the Israeli public in terms of, you are right that we've seen these disgusting videos of people sitting on hillsides with binoculars getting their jollies off while children are being shot and while medics are being shot while they come to aid the children. So you're right to say that you haven't.
They gave a hero's welcome and cheered as the rats that burn down houses and churches.
They do that, don't they?
And murdered babies.
But what do we know about
the
wider?
They gave them a welcome and gave money.
I'm not here to try and muddy the waters or cloud what you're saying. Far from it. I agree with you. But I wonder, is that the wider Israeli public feeling about it? Because you and I both know plenty of Jews. You mentioned Norm. No Norm for years.
I'm not just talking about Jews. I'm talking about Israel's. Israelis.
Of course, yeah. But
it's
I also
a culture. That's what they call themselves, and I don't like that because, like, most Jews in the world, most anybody in the world opposes all of that.
Yeah.
But within Israel, as Gilad Osman points out, they don't call themselves the Zionist state. Every single political party in Israel, there's the Z word doesn't come up. They call themselves the Jewish state.
The Jewish state.
They're not. That's their own. You know, they want to be there. They think God gave them land. The settlement, you start talking, the settlers are fanatic, just religious fanatics, just like Wahhabi Islam. There aren't a lot of people within ISIS that are moderate or something. Like, it's ISIS. They have that's not Islam, okay? And Zionism is not Judaism. But there are Zionists and there are Wahhabis. And Zionists and Wahhabis think like psychopaths. I mean, what the Wahhabis have done in Syria and Iraq, what they did in Libya, is atrocious. I mean, cutting off people's heads, eating organs, torturing people, killing children in front of their mothers, that all that barbarity. And you can see the Zionist army engaged in the same thing, beating them. Like, you'll see 6 or 7 armored soldiers beating the piss out of a 9-year-old unarmed kid. Like 4 or 5 adult, grown adults punching him in the face.
I saw the video on Twitter.
Pulling his pants off and stuff. That, you don't see that any other army except in, you know, in the thick of war or something, you know.
But you know what, Ryan? Can I just interject just for a sec? I wonder how much that is supported by ordinary day-to-day Israelis. That's my only point here. I don't know. You might be right. I wonder how many
The problem is,
we just don't
know.
And
I'd love to say, well, that's just bad apples, but it's actually the opposite. There are great people in Israel, and there are movements that are against that. There's Oasis for Peace. There's groups that are anti-Zionist within Israel. But the majority of the public, because of brainwashing and the way the education and the media is there, they want more blood. What Netanyahu, Barak, the Blue and White Party, what all of them are doing is promising more war, that we're going to go annex the entire West Bank, and we're going to take all of Golan Heights, and we're going to take it from Hezbollah, and we're going to take it to Syria, and the public's hooray, hooray.
Yeah.
So the majority of them, it's not usually in most places like in America, Britain, they say they're not going to go to war, and they lie, and then they do it anyway. But at least they have to tell the public, yeah, we're going to get out of here and come home. And then, of course, they just don't never keep their promises. In Israel, they promise more war. The only thing holding them back is the global opinion of their own behavior. It's bad PR for them to say, let's annex the entire Jordan Valley. But Netanyahu's saying that because he's tied. And so the worst thing is, I don't think even Netanyahu's that wicked, but he feels like, well, to stay in control, I got to promise the bloodthirsty public even more.
Yeah, politicians used to promise.
That's how it is.
Yeah, politicians used to promise fairy tale visions of utopian futures. They still do in the West, to a point in Israel. He promises mayhem. Before we talk about censorship for the last 10 or so minutes that we have today, let me just remind our listeners, you are with the Richie Allen Show. It's live right now on, well, it is, we're actually recording this conversation, but you're listening to the Richie Allen Show on Fab Radio 2 in Manchester. It's on air, exactly. We're on air. And it's, of course, on TuneIn Radio, triggerwarning.tv, my own website. Ryan Dawson is the guest, long overdue, by the way. ancreport.com. I'm sure you know all about it. His podcasts, his videos, and his excellent articles on geopolitical affairs, ancreport.com. Get on it. Now, Ryan, let's talk about censorship. We have the Digital Culture and Media Department here in the UK. It's run by a guy called Damian Collins. He's the Secretary for the for Digital Media and Culture. And he's the big guy going after fake news in the UK. He's the man charged with getting vaccine
and they
talk.
They decide what's fake news,
and
right?
What so isn't, Russiagate, right?
That's okay.
That's okay, right? So this was kind of amusing. Well, not really amusing, but I've been doing radio shows professionally for commercial stations and national radio and TV for donkey's years. It was a laugh for a while. Now it's not so funny. Not because I've had some issues. Not at all. It's not about me. But we are now
getting to after George Galloway.
This is it. So what's happening then? Well, you talked about Tulsi Gabbard suing Google. That sounds really interesting because they are trying to directly influence the outcome. As you quite rightly said earlier on, you said it yourself, not Russia, but Google and Facebook. Tulsi Gabbard is going after them. Give us the lowdown there. What's going on?
Yeah, she's suing them because when she was the most Googled candidate after the first set of when the debates that she was allowed to participate in, she ran Google ads and they put the handbrake on her and she discovered this. She's suing them for $50 million. And what we need that, but we need pressure from above and pressure from below. We need lawsuits. We need to push for, in the United States, the Antitrust Act, the Sherman Act, to break Google up because they have a monopoly with YouTube and so forth. But you need pressure from below too, from the free market that is bringing things like BitChute and VK and other alternatives where you can post videos or a Facebook-like platform where you have a messaging service and so on. And so you're seeing the Telegrams and Discords and the BitChutes and other alternatives pop up. But they're up against this giant. And so we're going to need both because you need a place for people to post. And YouTube started scaling back a little bit on its censorship as it saw that it was creating a new competition. They don't want to be the next MySpace. For you millennials out there, MySpace used to be as huge as Facebook. It was the third biggest site on the internet, and kaboom, it's on because of censorship. Prior to MySpace, it was AOL, America Online, and everybody used AOL for chat rooms, AOL homepages, etc. It's dead in the water. And so the free market can hammer a giant. It takes a while, but there have been things that look completely invincible that have totally fallen apart, and that can and will happen to Facebook. And you could see legitimate competition to YouTube, and it's because of their own behavior. Their ADL and SPLC sponsored censorship is going to bring them down. They are boiling the frog right now, but the moment there's a real viable alternative, everyone's going to leave, at least from the political sphere. And that is, billions of views that will go to another platform. But why wait for that? Because the market solutions are never instantaneous, and you have to go through a very painful process of dealing with the monopoly before you can get enough pressure for alternatives to arise. The other problem is that Google, by extension, YouTube, enjoys government subsidies. So it's not competing on a free market. They're sponsored in part by the state where the competition isn't. So that has to end. So I would love to see the antitrust laws enforced. I would love to see Google broken up. I'd love to see them getting sued over their censorship. They've hurt a lot of families. They hurt my family. They took away my revenue as they did many other people. Yeah. So did Vimeo. Vimeo walked away with $5,000 in profits, took down all my movies. And they all, it's always under the pretext of, hate speech or whatever, which says you can't promote violence. And then it lists a whole bunch of categories that you're not allowed to promote violence towards, which I think you could just say don't promote violence,
yeah,
period,
yeah,
to
yeah,
anybody,
absolutely.
Right? But, and I never have promoted violence. The irony is I'm fighting violence. I don't agree with racist ideologies or ethnostates or any of that mess. But I don't censor any of that either. I think we need more dialogue, less deplatforming, because I think sunshine is the best way to change someone's opinion on those things. But YouTube, you know, it's the ADL is their partner. My entire channel was erased in 2008, the day after the ADL partnered up with YouTube. They took down War by Deception and all my films. And so I had to use a channel I created prior to that became the new channel because I didn't like the name I made. So I made a second one. So I never broke their rules. You're not allowed to create new channels where I didn't. I went back to an old one and they've erased that one 3 times and brought it back. And every time, you know, it's months without revenue, months without being able to deliver the news. And so eventually the last time they did it, I decided to go to Ireland, which is where I was a few weeks ago, because that's where the headquarters of all of
that's
Google
right,
Europe
in Dublin,
is.
Yeah.
It was just as equal distance as the one in the United States from where I live. So I'd never been to Europe, so I went to Europe. Had a lovely time in Dublin, too, and talked to a bunch of bug men from Google. And it was very interesting because in the course of conversation where I'm explaining, look, we're not advocating violence is what your guideline says. If you want to make a new guideline that says you're not allowed to criticize Israel, then write that down and put it in there. But as it is, we're supposed to be allowed to criticize Israel as long as we're not promoting violence or prejudice. And they said, do you support Donald Trump? So they asked me.
They asked you that, did they? Wow.
There's another guy with me. I don't know if he wants to be named or not, but they asked us both, are you Trump supporters? And the other guy said, no, he's a Gabbard supporter. And I said, why don't supporter or not just a person? I agree with talking with North Korea. I don't agree with his Iran policy. I was okay with this deregulation he did here. I don't like what he's doing there. You know, I gave him a nuanced answer. I mean, I don't really in general support Trump. I did support him over Hillary, but just like I would support Obama over McCain, but I disagreed with everything that Obama did, which is slightly less bad than the alternative or whatever. But why would you even ask that? Like, what's it matter whether I support Trump or not? But of course, we have Google employees saying we can't allow another 2016, right?
Yeah,
and
this is in the record.
This is another interesting point. Yeah. I said, we're talking to these engineers. They say they're engineers. But see, I had some guys that have been fans of ANC who I don't know, but they know me. So I trust them. I sent them to Google first because no one knows who they look like or who they are. So they just went there all nonchalant and checked out the security and stuff. And then reported to another dude on a bicycle who came back to where I was. And these guys had pictures. Like they knew I was coming. It was so weird. When I actually landed in Britain first, and when I first got Wi-Fi in Heathrow, I have a letter from YouTube. And I've been trying to reach them for a human being for a year and a half because it's all bots, right?
Yeah.
Finally, there's a person that writes me this letter and says, we have heard of your public something like publicly written that I'm going to go to Google headquarters in the United Kingdom, and they go, just know that you will be escorted off the property and blah blah blah. And I said, it ain't illegal to try and talk to people. Escort me for what? Arrest me for what?
Yeah.
Plus, I have no intention of going to the Google in the UK. You have bad information because I was going to Ireland.
You're going to Dublin,
but
yeah.
I was doing everything just the wrong place. But how did they even know I was in the UK? The moment I was in the UK and turned on the phone, they knew where I was. They thought I was going to, I don't know what they thought, get hundreds of people to raid the office or something.
That's creepy. That is creepy.
It is really creepy.
Yeah.
And I said, well, you can fix this whole thing by taking the strikes off my channel and this, this, and this. And they like, okay, we'll put it in for another review. I'm like, I've been trying to talk to a person for a long time. And they, you know, They had erased like 90 videos, age restricted others, give me a warning and 2 strikes. So I put all my videos to private so they couldn't see them. They couldn't claim somebody flagged it because no one can even see it because they're all private, right? And it had been like that for months. We've been going to war with each other. But when I got to Dublin, I sent scouts, and these people, the security people, they had like 30 out there. And I know Gemma O'Doherty and other people are going there, and it's just like a few women. Like, there's no reason for them to have 30 security
guards.
Yeah,
but you know, they had our pictures waiting for me.
Like, I'm going to come with a AR-15 or something. Yeah, like, all I'm trying to do is talk to a person.
They thought Chuck Norris was going to show up, because I know all about the jiu-jitsu. They thought Chuck Norris was coming in. To be honest with you,
if I really wanted to get in there, I could have dropped a bunch of security guards. But eventually, if I can do what? I'm going to get arrested. I'm stuck on an island. I can't beat up the whole country or something. But probably my side would have won. I had the Irish deep. They really don't like what's called D4. But so I said, okay, I went back and I got my whole bunch of people, way more than they could have handled. I said, I just want you to stand here. I don't want you to yell or nothing. I just want them to see. Okay. So I had them across the street and I had them around the building, and they were like waiting for me to come too, because a lot of the Irish were excited that these Americans are coming and whatever. And so the bug men come outside. They don't want me in the building. And so I'm talking to these engineer people. And they're telling me the process to go through, and I've said I've already done X, Y, and Z, and da 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 da. And the Trump question comes up, and I get these emails and so on. And then in the middle of all this, I get a letter on my phone, and they've removed my strikes, and they removed my warning, and I'm now in good standing.
Result.
So I'm like, okay, that's all I wanted.
Result.
I said, yeah, I said, I want to. They're afraid of you coming in person, I'll tell you that. Yeah. I said, okay. Well, it looks like it's fixed on my half. And I said, but I found out that same day is when they erased James Alsup and Iconoclast and a bunch of other YouTubers, much larger channels than mine, over frivolous nonsense or whatever. So the next day I had to go back, and some of them got reinstated and some didn't. And then at that point, I just wanted to see a bit of Ireland, and I had my channel back. And so I started taking – I had over 3,000 videos to put back into public domain. So started working on that. But it worked. It was worth the trip for me anyway. It costs a lot to come.
Well, a lot of money. Of course it does.
To Ireland.
Absolutely.
Went there with a one-year-old, though. I thought in my head, I'm thinking, well, this would be good for his English, to be surrounded in an English-speaking country. You know, but that flight is pretty difficult with a baby. It's 15 hours from Singapore and 6 hours from Japan to Singapore. But he was good sport.
He was good.
That was worth it when we got there. And England was nice too. London not so much, but outside of London we had a good time. So
lovely. And about Ireland, just before we get a final word on Japan, about Dublin, because you did mention that London was, you know, because it is obviously very multicultural. I know. I had to say it. That's what they say. That's what the progressive media says, or the left, so-called left-leaning media.
I want to point out something about that word. Like, Hawaii is multicultural,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
There's Hawaiians, there are Californians, there are Koreans, there are Japanese, there are the natives, there. It's a multicultural American state, but it's a macro American culture. All these groups are assimilated to a point. They retain their subcultures, and you get your, you know, trying to have Hawaiian language and dishes and food and music and all these traditions and luau's and so on. And you get Japanese and Korean, and you get the cuisine and music and all the kind of stuff. Even martial arts like BJ Penn, a lot of jiu-jitsu and stuff in Japan has come to the Americas. That's multiculturalism, where people pick and choose the pluses and minuses from other places and mesh it together, and you make something great. Guam is another example, and these are places near me that I visit. So many different languages spoken in Guam, but it's all functional. It's still an American. It's America. It's definitely in London, I didn't see that. I saw more of like segregated sections, where this street's all Vietnamese, this one's all Pakistani, this one's all this.
Yeah.
It reminded me of New York City, where they have a Chinatown and a Little Italy and this and that, where no one's really, it's not.
There is no integration. There is no integration.
There's no integration at all.
No.
It's my way, the highway of competing groups, which is just like tribalism. It doesn't work. And there's no looming British culture that should be the adhesive for everyone else. Like, you're coming there, so you need to assimilate to Britain. If I leave my house, I have to speak Japanese. Have to, you know, like, And I can retain whatever of my own values and religion or lack thereof or whatever personally, and no one in Japan would care. But Japan is Japanese, and I thought England would be a bit more British. I'm not saying, like, you can always adopt things from other cultures and be like, oh, here they have curry here, and here's Taekwondo, and here's whatever place. You know, here's McDonald's from the United States, whatever. That's fine. But there has to be a degree of assimilation, and there isn't.
Let's have an argument in the autumn, in the fall, about culture, because I take a different perspective than you do on culture. I think we'd have a proper back and forth, right, you and me, in the very near future. I'd love to have you back on. Before Ryan goes, just that Japan question again. It's ancreport.com. You've been listening to Ryan Dawson. Thanks for giving us your time today, mate. I know you're into the evening there, and you do have a one-year-old who needs your attention as well. So I genuinely appreciate your time. I look at Japan and I think it'd be lovely to go there. And then I look at it, and it's not the, I don't think it's the Western media trying to portray Japan in a certain way. But whenever I see travel programs about the country, or documentaries, I think the people come across as being a bit strange, very Americanized, and very, I don't know, very eccentric. And I'm obviously getting the wrong impression, because you've lived there for years and you love the place. So I'm wrong about Japan, right? Because it seems to me like it's almost a bit like the Stepford Wives, Ryan, or something. But I must be wrong.
Well, I think a lot of TV programs sensationalize. And mostly they're very Tokyo-centric. And they'll go right to like Roppongi or something,
yeah,
and focus on the weirdest niche they could find. And that's kind of like going to New York City and thinking it's America.
Yeah.
It's a city. It's very different from Alabama or Alaska, or, you know, and there's a wide variety in Japan. I don't live in Tokyo, so I can't speak for them. And there is a lot of weird niches here. But what television shows and stuff, like, I'll see stuff on these programs like, I've never seen any of that, and I lived here for 10 years, you know? Like, I'll look it up and be like, oh, well, apparently it exists. Like, there's a guy that has a restaurant that serves bugs or something, or somebody married a hologram or whatever. Yeah. Like, that happened, you know? But you can find just as many weirdo stories about Florida, you know?
Of course.
That doesn't mean it's generally Manchester, how it is, of course, Florida, you know? Like,
yeah. You're absolutely right. Listen, thanks for the time today. Hugely regarded website, articles, videos, and of course podcasts, ancreport.com, Ryan Dawson. I'd love to get into what constitutes culture in the near future. I know it's a big thing to try and narrow down, but I like interviewing people. Now, I'm not comparing you at all. I don't think you fit any stereotype, which is a good thing. You couldn't pigeonhole you, I don't believe for a minute. I sometimes have people on who are very conservative, not so conservative, and, you know, conservative. And they mention culture, and I have a little nibble at them in my style. I don't believe in attacking people. And we just have a bit of a chat, and I ask them to, you know, to kind of describe their culture. And sometimes it gets interesting. So that'd be nice to talk about in the future. Mm. Thanks for sharing your thoughts on Saudi Arabia today, on Epstein, on the wars, on Yemen, on John Bolton, and everything else we've gotten into.
It all ties together, doesn't it?
Doesn't
Let's not take such a long absence next time.
No, well, what I'll do is, we're going to finish up now, obviously, and you can get back to domestic duties. We'll schedule something for, what are we now? We are mid to late September. We'll schedule something for mid to late October with your permission, and we'll get you on. And no, it's great to connect with you again today, Ryan. It should have happened a long time ago. I have a lot of time for you. And I think the thing that I love most about you, and it is a very rare thing, is your willingness to engage with people who would see the world completely different than you, but your willingness to demand on their behalf that they are listened to, they are heard, and they are not banned. That's a rare thing. Hayden Hewitt, LiveLeak.com, he's very much like you, would see the world differently than me and you, but would fight to the death for you not to be banned or censored in any way. That's a rare thing.
Many of the people I was defending, I
wouldn't agree with
them on anything.
Yeah.
You know.
But you have to defend
those.
Absolutely right. But we'll never get anywhere unless we allow every voice to the table, every opinion on the table. So sincere thanks for your time, my friend, and let's do it again in October. ancreport.com. If you haven't been there, I'm sure you have. Bookmark the site and check out Ryan Dawson on YouTube as well. Cheers for today, Ryan.
Thanks so much.
That was Ryan Dawson speaking to me this morning. We're back live in the room now. This is the Richie Allen Show. The time is coming up for 10 minutes to the top of the hour. Ryan is in Japan and found that really, really interesting this morning. Thanks for the tweets on it. Joe Public, Ryan's website, by the way, is ancreport.com. And he does a lot of very, very interesting work there. There are links there to his films as well and to the YouTube channel, which has nearly 50,000 subscribers, which is amazing, and thousands of videos, which were only recently reinstated. He's had a lot of issues with Google. And what a fascinating thing to listen to that, how he was able to... I mean, it was very expensive, obviously, going to Ireland and going to Dublin and meeting with Google people and demanding that they explain to him why it is that they had deleted his channel. I had no such luck myself with my first YouTube channel, but I had a little bit more joy when I got onto Google in Dublin about not being able to monetize videos on my second YouTube channel. And they did for a short time allow me to monetize. Now, 4 out of 5 videos now, they demonetize from the get-go immediately. And they determine that they are not suitable for monetization. His story much more interesting than mine because he went to see them and actually met with them and said, hey, look what's going on. I don't know if he's right about the market sorting out Google. I hope he is right. I don't know if he is. I wouldn't be as optimistic as Ryan about that, about the market sorting it out and about alternatives coming along that we can jump on, you know, that we can jump on board with. I'm not sure about that. He might be right, you know, I hope he is right, but I don't know. But really good stuff, and it'll be good to get him on to talk about culture in the autumn, in October, maybe late October, certainly before November anyway. Joe Public says, I worked in London some years ago and found it to be an absolute shithole. Yeah, I've mixed feelings about London. I lived in London in the mid-1990s for a year, in Kingston-upon-Thames. And I really enjoyed my time there. Really enjoyed my time there. And I didn't mind visiting London occasionally. But living in North London in 2013, I really didn't like it. And I understand why people don't like it. I think there are some beautiful places in London. My great mate Jean Ann Crowley, who might still be listening, I know she was listening to Ryan Dawson a few minutes ago. I know Jean Ann enjoyed her time as an actress in London and enjoyed it. And the festivities there, the social life there, the culture there. I didn't enjoy my time there in 2013. And I know the oft-mentioned Caroline, my partner, despised it and despised the commute from Wembley into central London and despised that madness. It is mad. And I guess any massive city with an enormous amount of people crammed into it, flooding the public transport stations in the morning when you've not got room to swing a cat. Not that you should be swinging any cat's mind. Any place like that is pretty tough, you know. And we'd come from Spain where we had an apartment on the beach and it wasn't crowded and there was massive amounts of open space, you know. There wasn't a lot of traffic. There weren't that many people around. You could go and meet loads of people if you wanted it, but we were away from it and we were on the beach. So it was obviously very difficult going from that into a big city. That being said, Manchester is massive. It's massive. You can't imagine how huge Manchester and Greater Manchester is unless you visit. But yet it doesn't have that negative vibe that maybe London has. It doesn't. Or maybe it's because I've romanticised Ireland myself in my own... Excuse me. Romanticised Manchester in my own mind. Maybe I have. I've always had a soft spot for Manchester, the city. So I don't know. Thanks for all the tweets. Thanks to William. Patricia was tweeting there about Epstein. How did Epstein... How could William Barr's father, Donald, give Epstein a teacher in the prestigious Dalton School in New York with no teaching credentials? Yeah. These are questions I'd love to have the answer for. I can speculate, of course. We can all speculate. I think we're all on the same page here. But having the proof, isn't it? Having the proof. That's the thing. That's it then, pretty much for Monday's programme. Thanks for listening in. I appreciate it. I'll be back with you on the YouTube live stream tomorrow morning at 9:30 a.m. That nonsense carry on every morning at 9:30, where we'll look through the UK's papers and talk about some of the stories inside. So if you are of a mind to do that, join me. Big thanks again to Ryan Dawson. His website is ancreport.com. In the event that you haven't come across him before, well, you have now. ancreport.com. We'll bring him on. I've got some good stuff lined up for the week, but typically my diary is not close to hand. It's not right here in the studio, but I've got some good stuff coming up for you throughout the course of the rest of the week. Have a brilliant rest of your Monday evening. We'll go out with The Who, so we will. Which I do occasionally go out with. Not for a while. And in mind, with Iran in mind and the claims being made against Iran by Donald Trump and Mike Pompeo, I think this might be pretty apt. This is Won't Get Fooled Again by The Who. Closing out Monday's Richie Allen Show. Love you. See you tomorrow. Bye for now. Bye.